Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderley. We're having a Friday Open Forum Hour. We're at 614-292-8513, and we'll be lining up your phone calls in just a moment with a lot of things to talk about. Well, you know from all our reporting and from the Columbus Dispatch, Ohio could face a shortfall of up to $1.9 billion in the next 1.5 years. The shortfall could range actually from $733 million to $1.9 billion. But as you know, the Ohio Constitution requires that the budget be balanced every 2 years. So Governor Strickland says he's not going to raise taxes, but rather he is going to make budget cuts, which is going to be tough because, you know, there are all these wonderful services that the state provides, everything from physical and mental health services to road repair. Then some of them are going to have to be cut. And the governor's office said it would be unrealistic to think that some people would not be laid off. In other words, there are going to be some layoffs for government workers. The Columbus Dispatch decided to make this their hot issue this week on the Internet, and they asked people what they think should, in order to overcome the budget shortfall potential, should we raise taxes or should we cut services? And again, Governor Strickland said he's not going to raise taxes. Well, 83% said cut services, and only 17% told the Dispatch raise taxes, an unscientific poll. But a couple of people here, this is what they wrote online at dispatch.com. One person said raise taxes. They said raise the income tax by 1% on just the richest 10% of the population. That will take us out of the red. Add some environmental taxes, like a tax on cars whose miles per gallon rating is under 20. Tax electricity for households that consume more than a certain amount of kilowatts per month per person. This will decrease overconsumption, decrease pollution, and dramatically bring down the electric bills of moderate consumers. Also, find ways to cut down on government bureaucracy and redundancy without cutting services or personnel. And another one says, cut services. The state wastes millions on unnecessary and questionable spending. Reduce the size and role of state government. Do only essential services, says this writer. Cut the education budget, the social services, environmental, and the advocate bureaucracies. Local government should not get state tax dollars. Government spending has become a complex, layered, wasteful mess from the federal to local levels with much duplication. We can't afford it. So what do you think? Should we raise taxes to overcome? And the budget shortfall has to be overcome because the Constitution says, look, you know, you've got to balance the two-year budget, and that's a constitutional requirement. So the governor says he's not going to raise taxes. Some people at dispatch.com thought we should. Some people thought, hey, the government provides many too many services. Cut them back. What do you think? 614-292-8513. Well, congressional leaders, as you know, announced that deal with the White House yesterday on their economic stimulus package. You could get a tax refund of up to $600, okay, and to $1,200 for a family, and more if you got children, less if you have made little money and did not pay taxes. I believe the figure, if you made only $3,000 last year, you'll get a rebate of only $300. Well, everybody likes money coming their way. Two things about this. Of course, it's also an incumbent protection plan for members of Congress who are up for re-election in November. Because isn't it nice, both Republican and Democrat, because, gee, isn't it nice that your congressman and your senator, some of the senators up for re-election, are sending you this wonderful check in the mail. You're going to feel good about voting your incumbent back into office, or you might. So I would characterize it as an incumbent protection plan. Also, it is said to stimulate the economy. Many economists agree that it will do that. You know, we'll go out and we'll spend the money and we'll go to such and such a store and we'll buy certain things. And because we buy them, that means the goods move. So more goods will have to be produced and therefore people will keep their jobs producing those goods. Not everybody agrees. Paul Krugman, the liberal economist for The New York Times, says that most of these tax rebates are being given to people who have more money and who have greater income, and they're just going to put it in the bank. They're not going to spend it because they don't have to. And he thought it should have devolved downward a little bit and that the greater amount of these rebates should be given to people with lower incomes. And he says he's not convinced that this is really going to work. Well, all kinds of things to talk about. 614-292-8513. Let's go to Henry. Hello, Henry. You're on the air.
Oh, yes, I am here.
You are here.
Okay. Hello?
Yes, Henry, you're here.
Okay. Well, since, I thought of one thing, but since you started with taxes, I will give my opinion. I could be facetious and say if we reduce our taxes to zero and no one pays any tax, then the country will be wonderful and we'll have loads of money for everything. But that's being facetious. I've made a study of taxes. The information is easily obtained. It's in the instruction booklet for the 1040 taxpayer paper.
Yeah.
And all one has to do is go to the tax table and then use some numbers and run calculations. And what I learned from that is contrary to what most people believe, people who work for a salary for an organization pay less in taxes than they think they do.
I think that's probably right.
Now I can't. Now I can't make. I can't comment for those who own a business. I have no idea because that's a different tax form. The other thing is you cannot include Social Security into the taxes because of, although it's called a Social Security tax, it is not a tax. It is a forced retirement system. And what it does is it keeps people from having to support their parents when their parents get old or push them out of the house. If I were a politician, and, well, I blame politicians for misleading the people and for not telling people that they paid less in taxes than they do. If I were a politician and I were running for election, I would stand in front of a crowd and say, you people are paying too much in taxes. Vote for me, and I will lower your taxes. And that's what politicians are doing.
Well, you know, when you say Social Security tax is not a tax, I mean, you could look at it, yeah, as an insurance premium, and you're going to get, if you have a lengthy lifespan, you're going to get far more back than you put in, I would suggest. But on the other hand, you could say it's a tax because it's taken out of present income, you know, for you and money your employer might have given you had he not had to pay the Social Security tax. So you could make the argument that that money would come directly to you and therefore it's a tax out of your income.
Yes, you could make that tax, and I think it's a play on words. I mean, there are so many things that we have to pay for. You have to pay for roads, you pay for schools, you pay for libraries, you pay for metro parks. You want to call them a house? You pay for your fire and your police, and your water and your utilities. You want to call that a tax? They're necessary.
Well,
where would we be without them?
Well, that's true. I mean, in other words, you know, one thing about us as Americans, it's almost a national character. We love the services we get. And they're vital to us, but we always complain about the money we have to spend for them, whether you call it taxes or whether you call it something else. So,
that's
politicians are aware of that. I mean, we like the Medicare drug benefit, you know, if we're on Medicare. We like the housing deduction in terms of our taxes on our houses, and yet we complain that we're overtaxed, and we're not exactly consistent in that way. Henry, got to go. Thanks very much for your call. Jordan is here. Hello, Jordan.
Good morning, Fred. Thank you again for taking my call. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
Don't want to go too long here. Just a couple of things. I really enjoyed the conversation last hour with the professor, and in all deference to her and her education, I think we have to remember the history is only relevant, has to be reasonably respected so we all maintain our perspective here as we live in the present day. We can always point to some place in history, I think most everybody can, and pull out some skeletons about every faith.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So fair enough that, you know, I think when Clinton called in, you know, I think he had a good message. I think he got a little off track. I want to support him and say the good professor said, you know, hey, there are Islamics out there for progress and peace and all this stuff. And I would just like to say, you know, where are they?
Oh, my goodness.
You know, and reasonably, where are they? Is the media in such control of our country that they're suppressing the Islamic movement for peace and prosperity and it goes contra the terrorists? You know, acts that we see every day over in the Middle East, and unfortunately we saw in our own country September 11th, 2001. I mean, I think, and then you go to Dr. King's movement.
Yeah, may I answer that question when you say, where are those Muslims who are for peace and prosperity?
Yeah, I think I have an answer, but please
my answer is, that, first of all, they're all over Columbus, and many of the Columbus Muslim leaders have been on this program absolutely condemning all acts of terrorism, speaking about peace and nonviolence. They're here. I believe the Fiqh Council of North America, which is one of the leading bodies for Muslims in America, theological bodies, has issued strong statements condemning absolutely any kind of terrorism. So they're there. They don't always get the coverage, you know, but they vociferously, you say, where are they? They're right here in your community. Jordan?
Hello?
Go ahead, Jordan.
Hello?
Yes, Jordan, you're on.
Oh, I'm sorry. A lot of beeps there. Well, I guess I don't disagree with you that there are voices out there, but I guess what I really want to do is, you know, she also referenced Dr. King's movement, which, of course, all of us respect, and the way that... I guess growing up as a kid, seeing that, you know, people in the streets in Selma and seeing it, you know, the marches across the country, and that was, you know, advocating that they deserved and were entitled to civil rights and to change and to respect, and they did all that nonviolently. And therein, I think, lied the wisdom of, you know, look, we're simply standing here saying we want what the Constitution of the United States says we're entitled to.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, anybody that advocated violence was dismissed from that movement. Mm-hmm. You know, I live in today's world with friends like yourself on the radio and friends of my own and people who I interact with. And I want peace and prosperity and all of that for my generation. And hopefully that would translate to the future. And sometimes when I hear this stuff about, well, the Christians, you know, you guys beat up on so-and-so 700, 800 years ago. Okay, fine. I understand that, and that was wrong. You know, we've evolved a bit, I believe, that was a long time ago, and we've evolved. And, and are we? It was this retribution now against us for the crimes the Christianity community committed then? I don't really think so, but I believe somewhere out there somebody feels that way. I guess that Clinton was trying to point out that he believes that Islam's own doctrine calls for subservience to those that are in power, and sometimes the impression that we're given from the mass media view of the Muslim faith is that they don't dare speak up.
But I don't think any of that's true.
I agree with you that there are many people, there are many Muslims who are speaking up. It's just that they don't get the airplay that obviously it's not as big news as blowing up yourself in a restaurant somewhere.
Well, I think, you know, but one of the problems that we have in the mass media is that we tend to emphasize the negative. When something awful happens,
absolutely.
That's
almost criminal.
So when good people make positive statements about peace and justice, often they're not heard on the media. You know, it's the most strident voices and the most negative events that always get the coverage.
And it's a shame. And I think we as Americans who champion, you know, freedom and freedom of speech ought to champion some of these more peaceful advocates. And I was hoping that maybe if anybody out there is hearing this conversation today, that some of the Muslim members of our community would call in and clear this up for us. But I want to say one more thing, and it's real quick.
By the way, I want to say that over the months here and the years, that many Muslim members of our community have called in.
I've heard them.
You know, so they're very prominent in defending, and when they get a chance to be on the media, they'll be right here. I just want to underline the basic bottom line for me is what Jill Carroll said, that if we take our images of other religions or other non-religions from the media, we've got a real problem because, as you noted, Jordan, the media has a bias toward the most strident voices and the most difficult events and the most horrific events.
Oh, yeah, the most
the way to do it is to get to know your neighbor who's a Muslim or your neighbor who's a Christian or your neighbor who's an atheist and find out the human being there.
Oh, absolutely. I you get no disagreement from me there.
Thanks, Jordan. Thanks for your call.
Great talking to you again, Fred. Take care.
Right. Bye-bye. And Mark is on the air. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Fred. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to refer to something said on your program by Jeff Cohen from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
Yeah, it's a progressive media watchdog organization. He was on the show the other day. Right.
He was speaking of Hillary Clinton, and I believe what he said was that there was no significant difference between her policy toward Iran and that of George W. Bush.
He at least wondered whether there was any, yeah.
Well, I have great respect for Mr. Cohen and the work he does, and I usually find myself in agreement with him. But I think on this issue that he's just dead wrong. Unfortunately, there seem to be as many Hillary bashers on the left side of the spectrum as there are on the right. And what he said really reminds me of Ralph Nader saying that there was no difference between Al Gore and George Bush. Now, after 7 years of George Bush, I think that we could all agree that that is wrong. But back to Hillary, if you look at the people that are supporting Hillary, one of her most ardent supporters is General Wesley Clark. And it's been there's been rumors that possibly if Hillary becomes president, that General Clark would be her Secretary of State. General Clark has been very outspoken in his criticism of Iran policy. He's even set up a website called StopIranWar.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it extremely unlikely that General Clark would be out there stumping for Hillary if he believed that her policy was not significantly different than George W. Bush's. I know there are a lot of people on the left that are not very fond of Hillary, but let's just stop this right now. And if you look at what General Clark and former President Bill Clinton were able to accomplish in Yugoslavia, and it's an area that's not that different from Iraq, if you contrast that with what George W. Bush did, think of Yugoslavia. It's a multi-ethnic, a multi-religious state. It was held together by a strong man. When the strong man was gone, the place fell apart into ethnic and religious conflict. And the approach that Clinton and Clark had was very different. They brought in allies. They relied on diplomacy, some very intense diplomatic efforts. And I think that is reflective of what you'll see from a Hillary Clinton administration, which is actually the complete opposite of what we've gotten from Bush.
Okay. Mark, thanks for your comments.
Oh, thank you, Fred.
And our next caller is Sarah. Hello, Sarah.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a complaint.
All right.
It seems that when the people who manage your station one tape is run, and then while they're putting on another tape, they play not music, but just loud, unpleasant noises. And I wish that they, as much nice music as is out there, I wish that they could select something a little bit easier to listen to.
Sarah, tell me, when do you hear this kind of music?
Well, it's between the time when the station is changing tapes.
Well, of course, we have breaks. Are you thinking of Morning Edition in the morning?
Well, I've noticed it several different times, but I can't pinpoint the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's most unpleasant and unnecessary.
Now, there are break periods in the morning when we're at the network and the network comes to us for local announcements. And, of course, often we call them music bridges. Many of those music bridges, of course, come from NPR. They come from the network. And they try to make the music bridges consonant with the story you've just heard, you know, and in some way reflective of the mood of the story you've just heard. So if it's a very somber story, you're likely to hear somber music. If it's a more sprightly story, you'll hear a little something different. We do, during our local breaks, also play some of our own music. It tends to be classical now. But I'm not sure which music you're referring to. But, when you hear something you don't like, give us a call and talk to our program director, Mike Rathke, and maybe we can pinpoint whether it comes from the network or whether we're doing something that's displeasing you.
Well, maybe if you pass this along, they'll see that it gets to the right place.
I will pass it along. We don't have a lot of control over what the network does, of course. They pretty much call their own shots.
Well, they might change if they had some input. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Sarah. Let's see what other callers have to say. Does anyone else find the music bridges, as we call them, pleasant or unpleasant? There's some defenders of those bridges as well. Next caller here is Bob. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hey, Fred. I'm glad we heard some forecasts today. I heard you mentioned that Paul Krugman from the New York Times, one of my least favorite economists.
I'll bet he is, yeah.
is saying that the tax cuts won't work. Well, I'm glad we've got him on the record now because I'm...
The tax rebates, yeah.
Tax rebates. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that these are going to be pretty necessary for the economy. And they work them pretty well. For one, they go back to any taxpayer that pays over $3,000. So this is going to be a highly regressive rebate.
That earns over $3,000. Yeah.
That earns over $3,000.
Even if they didn't pay any taxes.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly. If you have a paycheck and you've earned over $3,000, you're going to get a rebate.
Yeah, of at least $300, right?
Yeah. So it's going to be real interesting to see whether or not this works or not. I have a feeling with the coordinated activity of both Republicans and Democrats agreeing to tax cuts to stimulate the economy, combined with the incredibly stimulative monetary policy going on right now through the Federal Reserve, I have a feeling we're going to be able to resolve this this home loan crisis rather rapidly.
Well, hopefully.
And so, but the other thing that I was calling in about was a solution to Social Security. No matter who we get in office looking forward, we've got an entitlement time bomb that is going to be an absolute nightmare. I think I heard you say that on average you get back more money from Social Security than you pay in. Is that a correct statement? Okay, I don't think you can make that statement for a couple of reasons. One, it's dependent upon your life, your life expectancy.
Absolutely, yeah.
And
remember, I had a qualifier there. I said if you have a lengthy life, if you don't, you won't.
Oh, certainly. Okay. That's true. Yeah. Okay. Yes, you're absolutely right. However, there are certain groups, namely the poor and the black, that actually get negative returns. And more importantly, is you have to take a look into the amount that you paid into it. Social Security, when it started, you paid 1% into it. Now you're paying 12.4%. So you don't really know what the future generations are going to pay into the system. I can tell you that if you take the average person's lifetime, and they retire at 67 and they pass away at 80, if you add up the average benefits that they get, it sums up to be around $140,000. That's not a whole heck of a lot of money to be paying 12.4% of your income in to get back. So that's a pretty lousy return no matter how you look at it.
Of course, the 12.4% split between you and your employer, each of you paying half, right?
I don't think the bottom line is it comes out of...
Yeah.
I would never portray it that way. It comes out of the employer. Whether how it's accounted for is you could account for it. Bottom line is your employer, if you look at it that way, pays 100% of your payroll, so it pays 100% of your Social Security.
And
tax.
You would like to say if he gave you that money instead and you put it in a private account, you'd do better.
I'm going to say what we should do is very similar to what you and I get and through state teachers' retirement program. And I think if you look at that system, it gives a heck of a lot better return.
It does, yeah.
But the most important thing is that when you pay money into state teachers' retirement program, you are investing in America. You are strengthening the economy, and you're building jobs, firms, factories, and a future in a more competitive economy for our children. And you gain, and if it's done right through a defined contribution plan, you have an asset there that you can leave to your children. You can literally wipe out poverty in a couple of generations using that system. More importantly, if you just do the numbers on those things, if you just have a near equity return of 12.4% of your income, you literally save up over millions of dollars by the time you retire. So
you could indeed. Yeah, that's right.
So if you
presuming, let's say, an 8% return on your investment,
8% real return.
Yeah,
that's inflation adjusted. Now the other thing is, what we should do is we should. You know how we always hear about, the Democrats want to give us the same health care that our senators get. What we should do is start demanding that everybody gets the choice on what government pension they pay into so that you could choose STIRS, PERS, firemen's, and Social Security. So it would allow you to choose that, whatever system you wanted to. That way, you just simply have a fair system where you get to choose the retirement plan that you want. It's run by the government, but one of them's government run, one of them's basically a private sector. The other thing is people always say they want to copy the Canadian health care system. People don't know that Canada has a privatized Social Security system. So if we're going to copy Canada on anything, we should be copying it on their pension plan because what they're doing is they're strengthening their economy with theirs. We're weakening ours with ours. The liability right now is the unfunded liability is up to $40 to $70 trillion. That's five times our GDP. And we've left that liability to our children, which on a per capita basis or per household basis is over $500,000.
And Bob, we got to go.
Sure.
Thanks for your call today. We're going to break here for a couple of announcements in our Friday Open Forum Hour. Then back with you callers at WOSU 820, NPR News.
Next time on Day to Day.
States are putting the squeeze on so-called payday lenders.
And that means clamping down on super high interest loans.
But people who need the money complain states are putting the squeeze on them.
If I didn't have these guys, I would have lost my trailer for one, my truck for another.
It became a matter of survival.
Are these loans a lifeline, or are they drowning people in debt?
I see no way out.
Next time on Day to Day.
And Day to Day will be here in 30 minutes at noon, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jurevich. It is 15 degrees at 11:30. And please join WOSU 820 for President Bush's final State of the Union address, Monday night, January 28th at 9 p.m. Join us for live, in-depth coverage from NPR News, including reaction from political analysts and members of Congress, as well as the Democrats' response to the president's speech. That's President Bush's final State of the Union address, Monday night at 9 p.m., right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. And taking a look at the forecast for Central Ohio, sunny skies throughout the day today, a high of 25. For tonight, clouds moving in with a chance of a snow shower after midnight, a low of 17. The chance of snow tonight is 40%. And for the weekend, Saturday, cloudy, a high of 33. And on Sunday, partly sunny with a high of 33. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820, NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. We're right in the middle of an open forum at 292-8513. Currently, all of our phone lines are full. Callers, let's go right to you. Bill is on the line. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Fred. I had called in to sort of comment on some of the comments that were made during Ann Fisher's interview.
Ann Fisher, the Columbus Dispatch columnist, on the show earlier this week.
Okay. Right. Two topics were discussed, among others, public records and election information.
Mm-hmm.
But before I start saying the things I plan to say, when you talk about the teacher's retirement plan here in Ohio, the employee pays 10% of their wage, and the school district, I believe, pays 14%. So it's really 25% of one's income goes into that plan, not half of which.
We're talking about the state STRS now,
yep.
State Teacher Retirement Plan. I know with the PERS, of which I'm a member, the Public Employees Retirement System, I believe I'm paying it at the rate of around 9-point-something% now, and that's matched and more, you know, by to a certain degree, by a contribution from the state. So you're right; you got to put that matching state contribution
in as
well.
It's much higher than Social Security in terms of the amount that goes in. Just want to make that point. You might bring those numbers up when you start discussing this, because I don't know. Well, the last I heard, STRS was about 24% total. But those are round numbers.
All right.
Hey, going back to Ann Fisher's comments on public records, I don't believe I heard it discussed that the Ohio Attorney General Mark Dan is now requesting comments on his model public records policy, which is located on his website.
Oh, tell us about it.
Well, I submitted some comments, and one can Google it, probably easier than use the official, you know, URL,
mm-hmm.
and just Ohio, Mark Dan, Attorney General, whatever.
Sure.
Among other things, I suggested that the Attorney General provide more information on the preparation and preservation of minutes of public meetings. Keeping good minutes is about the only way citizens can find out what happened during the dialogue, you know, at one of their previous public meetings on, say, a school board or city council, because very few people attend the meetings.
Yes.
It's only when something comes up later, I wonder what happened back then.
Wouldn't it be nice to have them online, too? Huh?
Beg your pardon?
It would be nice to have those minutes online.
Well, in the case of the Columbus School District, I believe the school district radio station does have them on an archive that you can download now.
An audio archive, yeah.
Yeah, but that's part of the minutes.
Yep.
And if you throw that away, you don't have much left. And so I sent my copy, a copy of my minutes to my comments to the Attorney General, to Ann, and suggested just because she's a reporter, she hasn't lost her citizenship, she could make some comments if she wishes. And I brought this up so that anybody concerned can not only make comments, they could, if they wish to, they can request a public record from the Attorney General's office, namely, what were some of the comments that were made? In my case, it's my name's Bill Buckle, and you can ask for mine. And if you don't get them, there's something wrong with their system. That's my point of public records. It's got two edges.
Okay.
And the other was quickly the the election information, I believe there's probably complete agreement on for voters, the purpose of an election or a campaign is to, the purpose of the election is to select someone who will do the kind of things you think should be done to kind of push the country in the right direction in the case of the presidential race.
Mm-hmm.
Accordingly, now the press, if that's true, should discuss how all of the candidates stand on what they feel to be key issues.
Yes,
not just those that have a lot of money behind them.
Yes.
So in effect, the problem is not that voters are, what shall I say, lazy. Well, some may be, but of course, but by and large, if the press is not evenly providing those discussions of these key issues, then it's impossible for the voters to use their own profile and match it against somebody who's an unknown.
Yeah, that's true. And I would say we've really, the press as a whole collectively has pretty much fallen down on this. For example, if you were to say to me, Bill, where can I go on some press site, internet website, to find summary statements of all the presidential candidates of their positions, you know, on health care and national defense, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know of one. There may be one, but it's hard to come by. It makes it difficult for people, doesn't it?
Well, true and agreed. The I'll give you just one case in point, and I heard it discussed, I believe, on Democracy Now. Take the conflict that's going on in Palestine and find out where these people stand. Most of them don't even have a stand. And they reported from a Palestinian point of view, the only candidate out there is Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich. But now Dennis is gone of the whole pack, only one. And they're ignoring Ron Paul for a variety of reasons. And it's tough.
Well, Bill, I thank you for your call.
You bet.
Mm-hmm. Vaughn is next. Hello, Vaughn. Vaughn, are you here? And Vaughn is not here. He hung up. Oh, let us find somebody else here. Let's go to Joyce. Joyce, you're on the air.
Hi, I had two comments, or one comment and one question. The first, in regard to the previous caller's complaint about music,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what she's talking about, but I do know that when there's a game on, I'll be quietly listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or whatever it is, and all of a sudden I'm slammed in the ear by OSU music and shouting and things.
Okay.
And I wish you, the directors or whoever, could, like, tone it down and then tone it up again.
Okay.
But secondly, my more important question was, I loved the discussion the previous hour. And I've been worrying for months about essentially the issue of reification of religion, making religion exist apart from its adherents. I've heard you say, like, Islam is a religion of peace, or Christianity is a religion of peace. If there were no Christians today, would there still be Christianity? If all the Muslims disappeared, would there still be Islam?
Well, sure. Of course, the adherence to a particular religious doctrine or a particular religious sect, they, in essence, make it in practice what it is. And, of course, it evolves, does it not?
Yeah, that's what I'm, you know, the Christianity we're practicing today, or some of us, it's not the Christianity of 1,000 years ago. And it probably is not the Christianity of 1,000 years from now. So I don't think generalizations can be made. I think you have to look at very specific locations and temporal instances. And this is just something I've been worrying about, and I would love to hear other comments on.
No, I think you do. And of course, you say the Christianity practice now is not the same as centuries ago. I think it is to some extent. I mean, some of the doctrines remain the same. Some have evolved. You know, some of the ethical precepts certainly remain the same. But you're right. Yeah, you have to look at the religion as it is practiced. And, of course, depending on where you look and what portions of the world or in what portions of our country, you will see the practice change according to the local population. Huh?
Yeah, and there's also, at least in Christianity, there's some very selective, at least now, there's some very selective interpretations of the Bible, as we heard with the one of the previous callers, that, you know, my best friend and I decided we were going to read the Bible through and through, and we had to give up because there are parts that were just too bloody.
Hmm.
There's too many commandments that, you know, I cannot accept on a rational basis.
Well, again, you have many, many interpretations of the Bible. You know, privately, private people interpret the Hebrew Bible, the Christian Bible, and also different Christian denominations interpret it differently. Everyone from saying it is fundamentally the inerrant word of God and should be taken literally to those who would say it is highly metaphorical and even miracles should be thought of as metaphors. I mean, you have this huge, you know, span, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So, that's probably inevitable.
I would just like to hear other people's. Well, I enjoyed your comments, and I would like to hear other people's if anyone cares to make them.
Thanks, Joyce. Thanks for your call. And Scott is here. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about the tax package they're trying to pass.
Yeah.
I think the whole root cause of this is this is just going to be a temporary band-aid. This is my opinion, of course. I think Bush sees what's coming. He wants to save the economy and to do this, put a little band-aid, send us some money. Hopefully we're going to spend it. He doesn't understand that the money they're going to be giving it to us is just going to be money that's going to be printed out. We're going to be. He wants us to buy stuff that's made in another country. So the money's going to go back out of this country. I am surprised how many people don't know that most of the root causes problems we have now is all because of free trade. Free trade is one thing, but we don't have fair trade in this country at all. Ever since Clinton, about 14, 15 years ago, signed NAFTA and Bush CAFTA in 2004, we've been having problems. Over 10,000, 15,000 factories have gone overseas. The people who were making good money, that were putting money back into our economy right here in this country and paying into the Social Security and all that, those jobs are not here anymore.
Well, Scott, how would you change? How would you change the free trade system? What would you do?
That's really a good question. Have to be free trade. I'll give you an example. Last year, the year before, and I always remember this, Russia started to be doing some trading with China. So China says, okay, so you'll buy this and this, right? And Russia said, well, yeah, sure, but you got to buy this and this from us. The Chinese weren't happy about it, but they went along with it. The thing is, what we export is minuscule to what we import. The money just leaves the country. Did you know there's actual programs that help companies and factories and give them tax incentives to move their operation offshore?
Yeah, there are some of those programs. It's pretty astonishing.
It's unbelievable. I find it treasonous.
Of course, some of the money, it doesn't all go overseas. Let's say if I get a $600 tax rebate and I go out and I spend it and I buy some stuff, some of which is made overseas, nonetheless, it does provide jobs for people here in certainly in service industries, certainly in importing industries, etc. But some of that money, does go overseas. And you're right, there are some tax incentives for some companies to locate offshore. And that, a lot of people would be very concerned about that. And you're right, a lot of American manufacturing jobs have gone overseas since the free trade regimen came into effect. Some have come here as well. Japanese and German auto firms, for example, have located here. But overall, I think probably Ross Perot was right. There's been a brain drain out of the country and a manufacturing drain as well.
That's the problem. The money's just not coming back as much. I really believe that the good times are over, and we're looking. We're going to become a third world country almost. We're going to be like a colony, a part of a whole global organization. We're just going to be just another state, I don't know. You just have to make it free trade. That's one thing I liked about Dennis Kucinich. He wanted to get rid of free trade, but then there's other issues about him that I didn't like, of course. Mm-hmm. But we're looking at some hard times coming up. I mean, within the next 4 years.
Well, Scott, we have great American ingenuity and great productivity and great creativity. And, of course, those who would support free trade would say, yes, certain kinds of jobs have gone overseas, but we're creating more new jobs for every day. And not just, they would say, service industry jobs, but jobs in the high-tech realm, jobs
well,
in
what
realms.
What kind of jobs is my
jobs
father
in
going
realms,
to work?
Jobs in realms that are yet to be known because of our creativity, our originality, our invention. Now, what you're saying, what kind of jobs are people going to work in? That's what Pat Buchanan's argument. He says, retrain workers, he says, because of the global economy. What are you going to retrain them for? What jobs are they going to take?
Yeah,
Scott,
I
got to move on. I thank you for your call today. Paul is on the line. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Fred. Interesting conversation today. I would agree in some regard with the previous caller, but in that we are in for some hard times. At the same time, when you look at our consumption of the world's resources, even given our productivity, in Thomas Friedman's, the flat world concept, And I'm sure that there are some bubbles in his thinking that aren't quite accurate, but it's an excellent book, that we cannot continue to be 20% or whatever of the world's population and consume 65 or 70% of its resources. That's not sustainable. He's right. We are going to have to look at some, despite ingenuity, we're going to have to look at some decrease in some levels of our standard of living. That said...
Well, let me say this, Paul. Yeah, maybe a decrease in standard of living, but also there are ways we can consume less in all kinds of ways that indeed will not decrease our standard of living. For example, Ford Motor Company is working right now on a car, every part of which is recyclable. I mean, every piece that goes into that Ford automobile will be ultimately able to be recycled 100%. That's a decrease in consumption without a decrease in standard of living. We are moving toward all compact fluorescent bulbs in our homes and other kinds of bulbs that use less power. That's a decrease in consumption, but it's not a decrease in standard of living. So there's some of that, too.
Oh, I agree. It's not all gloom and doom. I'm just saying that we have to actually start doing some of the things we like to talk about.
Surely.
As opposed to just talking about them. The comments about Social Security, some previous callers, and I would rebut somewhat respectfully, that we got into the worst part of this mess within this administration. Clinton left the current administration with a budget surplus, which immediately was transformed into extremely generous tax breaks for very, very wealthy people, many of them who occupy, Wall Street and other environs. This whole subprime mess has to do with the very bright people on Wall Street who just, and the banks and the brokers and whatever, everybody got a little handoff during the process. Nobody cared whether the loan was viable or not, as long as they got their piece today in a commission or, we call it, origination, blah, 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 whatever the language is. And, of course, then the MBAs on Wall Street packaged all these things into bonds and sold them to, God help us, even, the state retirement system.
Yeah, well, indeed, and there was a lot of that. In other words, when Citigroup says we're going to have an $18 billion loss because of these defaults on mortgages, they weren't exercising, and they said themselves, they were self-critical, they said we weren't exercising due diligence here in terms of who we lent money to under what circumstances.
So going on with that concept toward the questions about Social Security. I mean, to me, Social Security is a combination of an income transfer from the present generation to the following generation, or in other words, from the kids to the parents, essentially. But it's also an insurance program. I mean, it doesn't cover just retirement, but that's, of course, the majority. When Bill Clinton left the budget surplus, we could have bought, by some estimates, as many as 25 to 40 years of additional coverage of Social Security without changing anything in the system if we had simply applied that budget surplus. Well, we didn't.
And nobody was planning to do that, right? I mean, no one suggested, did they, that that be applied to Social Security? Although, theoretically, you're right.
Well, I'm just saying we could have done some lot more useful things than start a war and various other adventures. And my concern is that if we try to privatize Social Security, nobody likes to talk about what I would call the bridge. In other words, if suddenly today's worker can take 4% of her earnings and direct it into something else, well, that money's not available now to pay current recipients. And
okay.
So, who covers that interim 4%? Because it is largely an income transfer.
Okay, George, Paul, we must move on. I thank you for your call.
All right.
Next caller here on our open forum is George. Hello, George.
Good morning, Fred.
Good morning.
I'm enjoying my singular open forum this week.
Well, glad you're enjoying it.
Thank you. Hey, listen, Bill Buckle was right on the contributions made over on the public sector side. It's like 14.5%.
Yeah.
And and for fire and police, it's a little higher. And the top of that dimension is the State Highway Patrol, where we generous taxpayers chip in over 24%, in addition to the 10% they take out. Now that's a 30-some percent whopping investment in your retirement. And you shouldn't have any problem understanding why you can retire in your early 50s and at a fairly substantial amount of money. And it's privately invested. And the singular key component is that not one dime of those pension programs, retirement money, goes to underwrite the less fortunate in our overall society. That last caller was right. You know, it is an insurance program. It's it covers everybody, but it's not funded by everybody. And that's therein lies the inequity. But that's not what I wanted to talk about today.
Yeah, that's right. People in the PERS system or the SDRS system are not, in that sense, doing their share of funding the Social Security system, which does cover everybody, even the less fortunate. That's right.
Well, I mean, there's SSI, there's disability, there's just a ton of money going on there. And you know, it sometimes amazes me of the amount of money that's actually gathered up by the government when you take a look at the horrendous amount of expenditures that go out in almost every direction, from our foreign involvements in the unfortunate war in Iraq to wherever else the United States puts a footprint down. We leave a trail of money behind that's just unbelievable, and it all comes back from us generous taxpayers. Hey, listen, I just want to point out we're still having a controversy on our voting machines in the state of Ohio. And I just want the folks to think about a couple of things. Number one, the big problem with Ms. Bruner's plan is that she doesn't want to count the ballots at the precinct level.
Now, and she's changed. You know, she's backed off on that.
Well,
she said initially that was true, but now she's saying she wants to be cooperative with the local elections boards, and she's saying, look, if you want to count it at the precinct level, that's okay.
Well, it's absolutely essential to be counted at the precinct level, because if it's not, I have no confidence in that vote tally that's be tallied at a central location where the possibility exists that some mischief may have happened in the in-between scenario. Perception is reality in a political arena, and this will not be tolerable.
Now, I think what you're going to see is, you're going to see when we move to paper ballots, you're going to actually see them counted at precinct level. And there's a variety of reasons that that's good. Number one, first of all, at the precinct level, you can change a vote if you overvote accidentally. The poll worker can talk to you about that if the vote is tallied right there. Secondly, you're right. There's no hanky-panky possible in transfer to a central location. I think that's what you're going to see happen.
Well, that's absolutely essential. And, you know, the ACLU's not given a proclivity to putting a lawsuit against liberal Democrats. And they have up in Cuyahoga County because the main problem with the program that Ms. Bruner wants to ram through, and she's going to do that for the primary up in Cuyahoga County, is that if a voter makes a mistake, there's no recourse. And that's the fundamental problem, and that's the basis of the ACLU lawsuit. My question is where's the Franklin County GOP? I mean, you know, isn't it about time that the GOP starts getting off their dead rear ends and starts standing up for some things? You don't hear bupkis out of this crowd. And I'm getting a little tired of the Republicans not standing in the trenches and getting beat up. You know, you got the New York Times endorsing McCain. McCain is every conservative Republican's biggest nightmare. And I mean, where's the GOP standing up to this kind of stuff? I mean, you just don't see it. So
okay, George, we must move on.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for your call. And hello, Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. How are you doing today?
Good.
Yes, I just wanted to make a couple of comments about the comment that the second caller, Jordan, had made in reference to where are the good Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
I am a member of Columbus's Muslim community. There are plenty of good Muslims who go to work every day, pay their taxes, are not committing any acts of terrorism like the media, unfortunately, would like to portray.
Oh, surely. Absolutely.
And if anyone would like to see good Muslims from the Middle East, I suggest everyone look through their local cable guide and find out which channel Current TV is on. There's tons of documentaries that are made by everyday people who had the luck of traveling over to the Middle East and interacting with the regular everyday citizens there, asking them questions upon their views of the war on terror and their opinions upon American public. And a lot of people would be very surprised to see how friendly the Middle Eastern community is towards the American people. It's just a problem with the foreign policies that the government has been portraying in a very shameful way, unfortunately, engaging in a lot of black ops affairs that we have no idea about. And it's taken many innocent lives all over Africa and the Middle East.
Well, I think that you suggest we watch these documentaries on television, and that may be a good idea. But I also think what Jill Carroll said, our religion scholar in the first hour, is absolutely essential. Get to know somebody of another faith. If you don't know any Christians, get to know them. If you don't know any Muslims, get to know them. You probably work with them, or they're probably either your neighbors. You know, so you can make an effort to sit down and talk. That's the way to find out. I think going to the media, I think, is pretty limited.
Definitely is. And unfortunately, here in the U.S., people have lost a sense of community. People don't even know their neighbors, don't even know the children who their kids go to school with, not even any good relationship with the actual adult who is teaching our children in the classrooms.
Yeah, often that's true. We're so often tired and worn out at the end of the day. We come home and we turn on the television, and that community spirit and that activity in the community is lessened. Robert Putnam in his book Bowling Alone suggested some years ago that we don't even go to the bowling leagues anymore. That's right.
I would like to see a lot of our good Christian brothers and sisters out there take a stand against a lot of these negative-minded Christians who we do have in our community. There's still a cry out in some areas such as Hilliard, Grove City, and Groveport for a racial holy war. There was just an incident in Hilliard this past week, which was broadcast by Channel 4 News, where a interracial couple had their home spray painted as well as their automobile spray painted.
Yeah, it's really important that people, that good Christians, good Muslims, good Jews, and good people of every religion and non-religion stand up and against these kinds of situations and let people know that this is a shameful activity. Steve, got to move on. I appreciate your call. Patty's on the line. Hello, Patty.
Good day to you, Fred. As you opened your show, the second hour of it, talking about taxes and money and responsibility, I'd like to address having true leadership in the state. And as we look at the problems with the voting machines that have been brought up through the Project Everest testing, there are huge problems with the machines. It's coming out across the country. And one of the things that I have asked for the Secretary of State, Attorney General, the governor, and the Senate Controlling Board, which approved the money for Project Everest, to do on November 30th, myself, Marge Creech, and Victoria Parks delivered a package. And in the package, it had two sample product liability lawsuits, actual ones in use in Nevada and Washington State, where they're asking for a recall and a refund on the voting machines. And with that in mind, instead of, I mean, I keep hearing how Ohio's going to spend their rainy day fund money, and to take rainy day fund money and give more of that money to the voting machine vendors who have machines that have huge problems already greatly troubles me. And there's going to be states all over the country that eventually are going to be wanting their money back on these machines. And I'd like to see Ohio go to the front of the line to ask for our money back. And we should not be investing further money in ES&S or Diebold.
Okay. Patty, thanks for your statement.
You're welcome, Fred.
And really, sorry we couldn't get to everybody today. We'll have another open forum next Wednesday. And by the way, on the show on Monday, last week we had Jennifer Brunner, the Secretary of State, on with her proposal for election reform and voting reform. We'll talk to Matt Damschroeder and Denny White here, the Director and Deputy Director of the Franklin County Board of Elections, on our show on Monday, and with their point of view in terms of how all of this is going to work in Franklin County for voters in Franklin County. Thanks to Nick Long on the phones, Amy Jurevich at the controls, an open line producer, Linda Taylor. And the news is next here at Listener Supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.